I'm so happy I'm seeing some familiar faces. Because I am so discombobulated, I can't even tell you how disoriented I am. And so I want to explain why. And when I was walking here, I realized, oh my God, this is the third noble truth. This is why. This is what I'm going to talk about. And I just have this experience to explain it. And you know, there is nothing better than an experience of something to use as a guide to help explain something. So we are starting the month out into the third noble truth, this idea, the truth of the cessation of suffering. And just to put it in a framework, we've already covered this, the truth of suffering, or dukkha, and we've already covered the truth of the origin of suffering, where the suffering arises out of. And so we've spent the last couple of months, you know, surrounded in dukkha. I think that word even sounds difficult, you know, it's dukkha. We've been surrounded in this suffering. And in some respects, we were supposed to stay in it, stay in that swirling energy of looking into the nature of difficulties and trying to understand what makes something difficult, where is it coming from, what's the origin of it, what distortions of mind are being triggered. So we've been spinning around in this kind of selfing, not letting things be, all of that, for a couple of months. And then we come to this third noble truth, and I always had a problem understanding why the third noble truth came third. I would always think that if I'm stuck in dukkha, and a lot of the emails I would get would be like, well, what do I do with that? So there's got to be a path, some instruction on how to, what to do with this dukkha, this difficulty that we're stuck in. And yet, before we even talk about the path to the cessation of suffering, we are at this third noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And so for a long time I wondered, what is it about this truth? Why would it be here and not after the fourth truth? Why wouldn't this be the fourth truth? Like, okay, we got the path, we got the dukkha, and then this is what you get once you start going on the path. And a lot of it, I think, you can begin to understand what happens when you understand dukkha. The more you delve into suffering, the more you look into suffering, the cessation of suffering becomes the thing that keeps you on the path. So it's almost like, to me, this truth is the inspiration to go on into the fourth noble truth. And without this truth before the four noble truth, you might get swallowed up by the first two. You might get swallowed up in the dukkha that you give up on the path before you even set out. And in some respects, I think of it as the way I think of this fourth noble truth when we get there next month with the Eightfold Path, is that that path is what's going to stir up all the dukkha in our lives. So there's this path that's constantly stirring up dukkha that we're going to work with, dukkha being the Pali word for suffering. So this path is stirring up all of this dukkha in our lives so we can see all this suffering. And the third truth is the inspiration that keeps us back on the path, back on the path, back on the path. So hopefully this talk won't be too rambling. I'm looking at my notes thinking, don't look down to worry, because it's just going to confuse you. There's actually a reason. There's an origin of why this is this way. But I'll try to see if I can explain it. It makes sense. But let's just start first with reading where this sutta, this what the sutta says about this third noble truth, what Buddha said. He said, now this bhikkhus, or practitioners, that's what I think of bhikkhus, for lay practitioners. So now this practitioners is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving, the craving we were talking about last month. So I gotta say this again. Now this, practitioners, is the noble truth of the cessation of dukkha, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go of that very craving. You do notice how many ways he described this third noble truth. I mean, we tend to say the third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha. But there's a lot of words here. And when I started looking them up, because I like to look up words, for some reason it gives me a sense of clarity when I know, I don't know if these words, the English, you know, translation of these words, how interconnected that is with what the actual Pali is. But when you start looking into the definitions of these words that are used in the way the Buddha was describing this, then this idea of cessation begins to open up a little bit more, I think. So let me just give you some definitions. If we start there, then maybe I think the rest of this talk will make a little bit more sense, maybe even to me. So first he called it remainderless. So I looked up remainder. It means the part that is left. It's the part that's left when the other people or things are gone, used up. It's the part that's left, the residue. So the remainderless means that there's no residue. There's no leftover stuff that we have to deal with. And it's the remainderless fading. Fading being to lose strength or freshness, to become weaker, to disappear gradually, to become less bright, the gradual change. So this residue is gradually fading away. And the cessation would be a stopping of some action, a pause or a stop. He's got four more words here. Renunciation, which is to say you will no longer accept, to formally give up, to refuse to follow, obey, or support any longer. He's got the word relinquishment here. To give up something, such as power, control, or possession, to another person or group. To just give up some power, some control you have, or some possession. He uses the word release, to allow, to leave, to set free, to stop holding, to allow, to enter the air, the water, the soil. And then he uses the word letting go. And if we keep the definition that Ajahn Sumedho I used last month, it would be just letting things be. So if you think about this, when Buddha was describing this third truth, he did not say the cessation of dukkha is the remainderless fading and cessation or renunciation or relinquishment or release or letting go. He said it's the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, release, and letting go. And the reason why I think that "and" is a big deal is because we have a tendency sometimes to box ourselves in practice of it being a certain way. So we decide what is the cessation of suffering. And if I don't have that, then it's, I don't have it, right? If I have any difficulty or if it's not fitting in my box, then it's not real. And this cessation of suffering, talking about this third truth, to me, if it's not the inspiration that keeps you on the path, then something's missing. And so it's kind of like taking away the box that we practice in and seeing what, if any, of these words show up in any given moment. Can we see a way to let something just be? Do we see a way to just let it leave, allow it to go? Can we see a way to just give up our power, kind of release control of something? Can we just refuse to accept the way things are going? Refuse to go any further down this pathway? Or let this kind of fading away of the sparkliness of what we're trapped in, could we let that fade away? That's what I kind of want to talk about. So I want to talk about it by telling you this little, this thing that happened. Why I'm so scattered, feels like I'm scattered. So last week, I went to see Hamilton. I begged all my family to go with me to see Hamilton, but no one that I knew was gonna chuck out the amount of money for those tickets. And I love the theater, and so I decided, okay, I cannot afford to pay some $600 to $1,300 for floor seats, which is where I would usually sit. So I decided, okay, I'm gonna get the cheap seats, cheaper seats, and that's okay. It's not the seats I would want, but I will be happy seeing that, because I'll see it. And so last week, I bought my ticket, went by myself, I went to see it. Oh my God, I fell in love with that musical. It was so good. And between seeing Hamilton and seeing Black Panther, I got caught in this high, this energy, this sense of dignity and pride around being Black, and I'm just so happy, and I'm skipping along. And you can begin to see that dukkha is coming quick. It's going to start something. It's not that I want to say that if we're really, really happy, that something bad is right around the corner. But what happened was I lost the attention to what was going on with me. And I am letting the conditions around me set the tone for how I feel. So wouldn't you know it, I'm just talking to everybody I know about Hamilton, how happy I am, I got to go see it. And a friend of mine says, I really wanted to go. And I said, oh yeah, you should go. And they're like, if I go, will you go? If I buy you a ticket, will you go a second time? I'm like, totally, that's perfect. And now he wants to buy tickets on the floor. So, you know, my mind is already set for, I'm gonna fix that wrong that I had to go sit back in the, what I would consider cheap seats. I'm gonna fix that. I'm gonna go sit on the floor. I got great seats. We looked at these seats and on the different days, and oh, I was in heaven. This was on the weekend. So just to make sure I really got into it, I bought the DVD or the CD, and I'm listening to the music over and over and over and over and over, and I'm happy and everything's great. And then I get this text from him that says, Tori, I have been thinking, I just can't pay that kind of money. I just can't do it, I'm sorry. I want to, but I just can't do it. And I'm like, oh, it's okay, no problem. I was so disappointed. And the disappointment, I've already seen it. I just want to be clear about this. The disappointment was I was going to fix the problem I had with my original seats. But I didn't pay attention to that disappointment. I just started listening to the music, listening to the music, listening to the music, listening to the music. I probably read more about American history from that period of the Revolutionary War. I had to read up about everybody and who did what and how accurate was this. And I'm just reading, reading, reading now for like 3 or 4 days. So then today comes when I start preparing for my talk. And guess what is on my mind? The Revolutionary War. All the music, I can't seem to get, I tried by force to get this music to go away now. I need to focus on the third noble truth, and I cannot do it. I tried all day long, and I could not do it. And then something happened. I had this moment when I realized, this is not going away. This is it. This is what my talk is going to be about. I didn't think about my talk was going to be about what happened. What I realized was I was going to have a talk, and it was going to be whatever it was going to be. And I was going to have to let go of trying to force it to be a certain thing. And when I did, it is the nature of this practice. It began to open up and things begin to change. And so I'd like to talk about this third noble truth. If we could see it in three different dimensions, there's like three different dimensions we could begin to approach this and begin to see what this truth could provide for us if we practice specifically with the truth. Greg Sheff, I think his name is pronounced Sheff, he's a teacher at Spirit Rock, and I have a quote of his about Buddha's statement that I come to teach one thing only. He says, now and before I teach one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And Greg said that he always thought of this as two things, me too, suffering and the end of suffering. This idea that it's one thing doesn't make any sense. But then he realized that it is one thing, suffering and the end of suffering, that they are linked, he said. They are a unit. They are inextricably linked. He said, if we understood suffering completely, that is the end of suffering. That if you understand where you are in that moment, that is the end of suffering. So the three ways I'd like to look at this end of suffering is first to consider the distinction. If we practiced with this distinction, let me back up a little bit. The three things I want to talk about are the insights I think we get when we start practicing around this third truth. And the first one is this insight into the distinction between bare experience and loaded experience. Or another way I like to think about it is it's noticing the difference between the conditional and the unconditional. Much of the suffering we talked about, much of the dukkha we talked about for the last couple of months, it exists in our selfing. It exists in our sense of self. And we say that in this practice all the time, the sense of self and who we are, and there's no self and there's no being. But when you actually begin to think about there's no self, it doesn't really make any sense. It doesn't make sense that there's no self here because everybody in this room thinks that they are sitting here in this room. This concept of non-self gets very, very, very constricted. And in a conditioned world, having a self becomes very important. It becomes important because I'm the one that has to give a Dhamma talk. I'm the one that has to sit there and write this talk out and be prepared. But on the other hand, I don't think I'm the one sitting here giving this talk. There's a talk, I know. But if I really give a Dhamma talk, there's no Tuareg sitting here giving it. I'm hoping this doesn't sound so far, but it has to somehow be further than our minds normally think. Because if we're locked in trying to see the cessation of suffering from a mind that judges everything as good, bad, right, wrong, or mind or not mind, and how it affects me or doesn't affect me, then we won't see the far-reaching depth of where the practice can go. So instead of trying to see that there's no self here, instead, what happened was this flip in the middle of me preparing for this talk, that I stopped thinking that the talk was about me. I stopped thinking that somehow I had to give a certain talk for a certain thing, and instead trusted that in the moment I'll be able to say what it is that I need to say. Can you see how it's sort of like what I did was I allowed it to just be. I just allow that tension to leave. I let this gradual fading away of this angst around what I'm supposed to do and let it just be the way it is. One of the most sort of connecting pieces in this third noble truth is our ability to see how we're selfing around some given moment. How am I trying my best to make it be a certain way? Whether it's that way or not, this forceful way in which we are battling with reality. But somehow, if we remember all of these words that the Buddha put into place, it may be that the word that is most closest to cessation in the moment of someone's suffering is the idea that we just let it be. That may be the closest that you could see. On another hand, it could be that you just give up the power, that give up the need to control it or make it be a certain way. It could be that you just allow it to leave. Whatever that thing is you're holding on to, you just allow it to leave. Or you notice that there's a gradual sort of weakening character to it. Joseph Goldstein said, that when we see deeply that all that is subject to arising is also subject to cessation, that whatever arises will also pass away, the mind becomes disenchanted, becoming disenchanted, one becomes dispassionate, and through dispassion, the mind is liberated. Whenever I thought of the word dispassion or disenchantment, I always thought of a kind of a disappointment, kind of a giving up. Okay, I can't go. That kind of energy. But what I felt when I was sitting there preparing for this talk and I let go was a disenchantment with the thing being a certain way. I felt a dispassion to doing it a certain way, being a certain way, having a certain kind of a talk. Which goes to the second aspect of the second insight I think that comes when we begin to practice with this third noble truth. We could think of it as, to me, it's like two ways of seeing release. One release is a physical release, and the other release is a mental, it's a natural release that arises out of seeing things as they truly are. So the best way I can explain the physical release is the pressure we impose upon ourselves to make things a certain way. So all of the pressure that I was imposing upon myself to not think about the music was, in effect, creating more and more and more suffering and more and more and more tension. You can think about all the times that you have tried to not do some habit, to not do something, or wish something would stop, especially with obsessive thinking. This idea that we could somehow make ourselves not obsess over something. And it doesn't work. We end up getting stuck, trapped in our own minds, thinking over and over and over about the very thing we want to get rid of, or the very thing we want to give up. So there's another way that the third noble truth works on us. There's a woman named Elizabeth Elliot. This is a Christian quote, but she says, "The only basis of peace is the cessation of the conflict between two wills, my will versus God." It's not so much that I think that this is about a conflict between God and my will, as much as I'm saying there's a conflict between my will and reality. And it's not until you see that conflict that the cessation of suffering is even possible. You have to see that inherent in a conflict, in a moment of dukkha, in a time of dukkha, inherent in that dukkha is also this pushing, this force of two wills, mind and the will of nature, or the universal nature of the way things are, or you could call it reality. So somehow or another, in that moment of time, we're trying to actually see that conflict. Here's something that Sumedho said. "People rarely realize non-suffering because it takes a special kind of willingness in order to ponder and investigate and get beyond the gross and the obvious. It takes a willingness to actually look at your own reactions, to be able to see the attachments and to contemplate what does attachment feel like." So, if I can stretch our conversation a little bit, I hope you understand that I didn't know I was spinning around in the Hamilton CD all day. I didn't know that. What I realized was I can't think of what to say, and I kept writing and I don't like that, I never questioned why I was having all this difficulty, just fighting with this and grumbling about that and trying to write that and, okay, I'll read some more and I'll look at this and I'm doing all these things. And all this tension is building, but I'm not really questioning why this tension is building. I'm not really looking into the nature of the difficulty I'm having. It took most of the day before I actually decided to say, wait, what is this difficulty? And I just sat for a little bit, just a minute or two, just what is this? And that's when I heard it. That's when I heard all the music, just singing and singing and happy. And I actually realized that the moment I started listening to all the music in my head, that's where I wanted to be. That's where I wanted to, so when I realized I was disappointed, I wasn't going to go a second time and fix the mistake I made the first time. But that's where my mind was in that music, not in preparing. I mean, I did prepare, but it just didn't have the quality of what I was used to. Willa Tania Reed, she has come here before, and she has this really nice quote here. It says, "The point of practice is not to have pleasant feelings, but to be freed from dependent upon feelings." You can begin to see, I'm hoping you can see, that part of the inherent freedom and liberation that comes in actually practicing with this third truth, actually practicing with this idea that there is cessation of suffering, that somehow or another we could see outside of our normal way of relating. So I want to get to this very last insight I think we get, this third insight. Is one of the areas that is talked about with, whenever we talk about this third noble truth, is Nibbana. This idea, Nibbana, I don't even know what the, now that I think about it, I don't even know, it's a Pali word, but I don't know what the English translation of it is, because I've always just called it Nibbana, but I think it's awakening, or it's the enlightenment. So then, everyone in this room, when we begin to practice, there's a place where we have to decide, do we think of Nibbana as this kind of temporary thing that just sort of happens, or do we think of Nibbana as some permanent state of the total and complete cessation of suffering? Here's another quote from the Buddha. It says, "There is, monks or practitioners, an unborn, an unbecome, an unmade, an unconditioned. If, practitioners, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. But because there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, therefore an escape is discerned from what is born, what is made, what is become, and what is conditioned." So what that says is, in the back of my mind, there's always this kind of questioning, I think, that happens. And I think it comes from years and years and years of practice, but I think it also comes from constantly practicing into the third noble truth. And there's always this question in the back of my mind, is there tension here? Is there tension here? Is there tension here? Is there pressure here? Is there attachment here? Is there control here? There's this questioning that goes on, and I don't always hear it right away. But it's coming up close. And I personally believe that there is a state in which I would be free of all of that attachment and grasping and attention, the tension and dukkha, in a permanent kind of state, in this living in an unconditional state of cessation of suffering, of nibbana. It's not there with me now, but I believe that that's where it is. So because I believe that's where it is, there's a part of me that is forever looking into the nature of dukkha, looking into the nature of difficulty, looking into my tensions and struggles. Someone asked the Buddha once, is it possible to be freed from all this clinging and suffering? Is it possible through your own practice to affect change in the mind? No, I'm sorry. It's not somebody that was asked of the Buddha. That was somebody that asked Joseph. And he gave Buddha's answer that if it were not possible, I would not ask you to do it. It's kind of strange. All this stuff I read up on around this, and part of the reason why it's hard to talk about the Third Noble Truth is because it's so interconnected to the level of trust and faith that each and every one of us has in the ending of suffering. And what exactly the ending of suffering looks like for you. So here's some things that other people have said about it. Bhikkhu Bodhi said, it's profound, hard to see and hard to understand. And it's unattainable by mere reasoning. This understanding of the cessation of suffering. Buddha said that it was to be experienced by the wise. And then he said this also. He said, if even for the lasting of a finger snap, a monk or practitioner should practice the recollection of the peace of Nibbana, such a one may be called a practitioner. She is one whose meditation is not fruitless. So, that's it. You just have to think about it that much. But I think the question is, do we think about getting rid of the difficulty, whatever difficulty is there? Or do we think about letting whatever situation that has arisen be. So somebody asked me, someone asked me about a couple of months ago, we got into this back and forth about practice and social justice issues. And this person was challenging this idea that a practice where you let things be could ever in any way be liberating or any good to society anywhere, as difficult as things are. And I think I don't know if I can explain it all the way, but this is the way I begin to understand what it is that I hold true around this practice and why the Third Noble Truth is so important. difficulty in life is just part of being human. Difficulty, problems, struggle, stress, that's all part of being human. That's what you're learning in the first and the second truth. You're learning that dukkha and its inherent attachment to us is part, because we live in a world, we live in an existence where everything that arises ceases. Everything that starts ceases. So there is this constant moving, shifting, changing, instability, unreliability in 99% of everything we deal with in life. But the suffering with that, that is optional. That we pick up and choose for ourselves. And this truth is about seeing that. This truth is not so much about seeing, is there difficulty around? That's the first and second truth. This truth is seeing that your struggle against whatever is happening in the moment is optional. You may not like what's happening. You may not agree with what's happening. But the struggling, the pushing, the difficulty, that's all optional. And if that's optional, then you got to ask yourself, if we're going to live in the times we're living in, do you want to live in these times with the energy to do what's necessary? Or do you want to live in these times wrapped and trapped in the mind's obsession over it? So I'll leave you with one last quote. This is on the idea of Nibbana. Nibbana is not produced, does not age, does not suffer death, does not pass out of existence, does not come into existence, cannot be forcibly handled, cannot be carried away by thieves. It rests on nothing. It is the pathway of the noble. It presents no obstacles, and it is endless. So I'll just leave that there. And we'll take a moment of silence. Okay, so if there's any questions, see if I can answer them. Yeah?
I'm wondering if you think there's self-awareness that you're in Nirvana.
Excuse me?
If you have achieved so-called Nirvana, do you think you're aware that you're in Nirvana, or do you think, like, you label? Do those who think they label it, or do they just experience it and still think that they're caught up?
I think the question is, if you're in Nibbana, would there be self-awareness that you are in Nibbana? Well, I guess the way I would answer it is the Buddha knew he was awake. And so Buddhas know when they're awake. I don't think they have the need to go about talking about it. But Deepama, this is the way she described the state. I think I have her quote here. Maybe not. But Deepama, she's passed away now, but she was considered enlightened being. And she said the only thing in her mind was awareness and love. So it's sort of like there's a knowing that you are awakened or that you have this understanding. But you still live in a conditioned world. You're just not, Willow would say, you're just not controlled by it. It's more like that. You just don't have that. You're still subject to conditions. Like someone told me that Buddha had headaches. I think that's what Danielle said, that she was doing her studies and she learned that Buddha had headaches. So it's not like you're not part of the world. You're just aware. And when I think about times I've been on long retreats, probably the best way to describe the end of a long retreat is a sense that everything has slowed down to a pace where you just don't have to push against things and fight amongst things. But most of this is if we spend the time just paying attention to the actual moment of our tension, the fighting, the battle, the struggle we're having in that moment, it's in that moment you'll see the actual struggling going on. And when you see the struggling going on, releasing it, letting it go, letting it be, all of those words, relinquishment, the remainderless fading away, all of that becomes completely understandable in the moment that you actually see that their attention is there. So I would think that they are aware. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You had a reaction, you got very angry, and mm-hmm. You told a great story about how you learned that anger is okay, you know, to understand. In Nirvana, do you think you would have anger and just not have it last as long?
So the question I had shared before about being on a retreat and getting really angry and then learning to practice with that anger and being with the anger and not having to make it go away. And the question is, do you think that in Nirvana you'd even have that anger? And so this is kind of difficult here because one, I don't know. But the more important is that question right there is what you should be looking at. Like, could I be? That's the whole point of this week, this month, looking into the Third Noble Truth, is looking into where cessation exists. And the best way to know if you can have anger and be in that cessation is when you're angry, look for the cessation in that moment. In that anger, look for where you're holding. Where's the look for the rising and falling. What part are you trying to hold on to in this moment to make something be, or look for yourselfing in that moment in time. So the more you want to look into the difficulty with anger, the more you see anger for the true way that it is, what exactly it is. And what we call anger may or may not exist in Nirvana. But it will not be the box that you think anger is. So if you think anger is this box of anger all in there, when you start practicing with anger, Nibbana or no Nibbana, you begin to see that anger is not what I thought anger was. So this idea of, would you be angry if you were enlightened? I don't know. But I do know that if you practice in anger, you can still get enlightened, angry or not. If that makes sense. Hold on one second. Yes, in the back. Yeah.
Earlier you were talking about dispassionate and that word sort of connects with emotions, at least in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're discussing anger. Is it that you allow, you know, if you're allowing things to be or
So the question is, thinking about dispassion and thinking about anger, the comments, whether, you know, clearly they would have emotions, and I don't know. I've never met Deepa Ma, so I just don't know. But the quality that we want to look for is that all of those questions are so important to look into. So it's sort of like, I think this month is about questioning into exactly what you're questioning into. So it's sort of like when you're having some emotional thing, for instance, when I think about dispassion and disenchantment, it sounds sad, right? It sounds like I would just be bored and sad and I don't have any love anymore, and I can get pretty excitable. And it's just like no excitement, no joy, just thud, blah. But when I feel dispassion, and I feel that disenchantment, it does not feel blah by any stretch of the imagination. It feels freeing. It feels like I'm not under the grip of something that's got to be this way and this way only. And instead, I think the dispassion is around the dukkha and not dispassion like we think of, I don't have any more passion or enchantment in life. It's the dispassion in the conditioned things being a certain way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think this is kind of along the same thread, but the way I kind of understand this versus the second noble truth is the second noble truth is about the clinging, and this is about seeing that kind of the release, the relinquishment, and what effect that has on the clinging, and you know, practicing those with the clinging and seeing the ending of things.
Yes.
And just practicing with seeing the ending of things, and you know, that's what this is about, as opposed to, I think when I first heard about this, it was like, well, it's about Nibbana, but Nibbana is you know, it's very easy to just cling to that.
Yes. So the comment is that this truth is about seeing the endings of things and its relationship with the second noble truth. Is that the second noble truth we're seeing the clinging, and then this is about seeing the relationship that clinging has to the end of things and the natural ceasing of things, which is true. But I'm hoping I'm pushing us a little bit further than that, because if it's just about seeing the end of clinging in a moment here and there, that's true. That seeing is inspiring and keeps us on the path. But to then not take this one step further to beginning to actually consider where I am on this idea of Nibbana, where I am on the idea of, can I see the ending of all suffering? Then that puts like a limitation on practice to just being able to help me get through a moment of tension. But we were talking in the Capitol Hill group, and this reminds me of this. Somebody said, well, you know, Nibbana, that he was saying something along the same lines of what you're saying. Nibbana, didn't you end up just clinging to wanting Nibbana and always trying to get this state of forever, no more suffering? But this is the way I kind of think of this, and this is the way I kind of explained it then. We exist in a conditioned world, and every once in a while, we get these little glimpses of liberation, these little glimpses of these moments. But if you listen to people talking about their liberation, they will tell you with particular detail exactly what happened. They can tell you almost verbatim what happened 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, this moment when they saw into this release. And so we live in a world where we think the tensions, the dukkha, the samsara that we talked about last month, this constant wandering, this constant pressure, this constant trying to make our way through, we think of that as the norm. And every once in a while, we have these moments where we open up and see. And I'm not saying that that's not the way it is for me and most of us, but what I'm saying is, what if the norm was the open, and every once in a while we had these moments of being closed and we could see that we're closed? And I know that seems like that is not possible, because this is the norm, this constant battle that we're in all the time. But I think this noble truth is really designed to get us to see even beyond the temporary moments when we let go of a clinging in a moment in time, when we let go of a holding on, and we just see some moment when I can just let go, I can just be with it, and we can let go and we can feel that sense of release. But I think the distortion is that we cannot live in that state all the time. But I think we can. I think we could practice towards living in that state all the time. But in order to practice towards it, we would have to actually begin to question, is it even possible to live that way? And is it possible to live that way in this lifetime? That's what we want to see if we can look into this month. Is it possible? Because I believe if we believed it were possible, then when you turn towards the fourth noble truth, whatever aligning you have to do, you can be able to do it. But if we hold the third noble truth into a limited box of moments of release, then ultimately we will put the fourth noble truth into boxes of what I'm willing to do, instead of this much more open, broader sense of it's all possible. Yeah.
At least you talk about letting go and letting be. I guess, what do you know when you're, there's a balance in that, and then you start going into rationalizing or denying? I guess that's what.
Yes. I think that's what my friend was poking at, was this idea that if you let go, let be, that somehow or another, you're denying the difficulty that exists. But I think, from my perspective, that's not what this truth is pointing to. What the truth is pointing to is that if you let something be, and you're not pushing up against it, your ability to see it in reality as it actually is far greater. It's more expansive. Then when we are seeing it in the prism of the way we think it is, that's what we're pushing against. So your pushing may be of no, it may have no effect at all, because what you're pushing is not really, it's sort of like, I hate to keep coming back to my example with the music, but it was just so dominant in my life today. But that's what was happening. I was pushing against trying to come up with words and think of what to say and how am I going to say it and write it all out. And none of that pushing had anything to do with what was actually going on, which is this constant singing in the back of my mind. This constant leaning into that music is what was actually happening. So because I was so busy trying to push my way to do a certain thing, I couldn't see what was actually going on. And I couldn't let go of the clinging because I was too busy trying to make it be a certain way. Do you see what I'm saying? The idea of this truth is to look into that very nature of where you're having the difficulty. So instead of me trying to figure my way out of the dilemma, I just would accept that the dilemma's there. So it's the same way with our society and all the different issues that are coming up. We just accept that this is the way it is. And then you can look at it and see the appropriate way to respond. But if you're stuck in the pushing and reacting to what you think is going on, then you're not necessarily seeing it the way it is. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
I was able to go to the conference, the Wisdom Conference, this last weekend.
Faces?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I had never heard of that before, but it sounds to me like it applies to what you're...
It does.
That the recognizing something is wrong or something is... And then allowing it to be. And then maybe that's enough, just by allowing it to be, that it might morph into ease or...
Well, it's so the point is that what, just for the video, that the questioner went to the FACES conference and learned about this acronym RAIN, which is recognizing, allowing, its interest or investigate, and then non-identification or non-judgment. They're saying nurture. Okay, so the idea is that when we push against something that we think is happening, we're not necessarily looking at reality. We're looking at our perception of what reality is. And that pushing against that is what creates all this dukkha. than all the suffering that ends up showing up in our lives. But if you recognize there's some pushing going on and you just allow that, this moment to be, it doesn't mean that you're going to agree with what's happening, and it doesn't mean you're not going to do anything. It just means you're going to allow yourself to see what is actually going on here, and then get interested and investigate it, and then you'll know what's the appropriate response. A response that's in relation to whatever that is. And it could be, renunciation or walking away or standing up or whatever the response is. You may have to say something or do something, but you're doing it in the actual response, in relation to the actual conflict or the difficulty there. I think this truth is trying to, I think if we see this truth in relation to the looking at dukkha and the path that we're going to talk about next month, then you can begin to see that if we're not willing to see into the possibility of the cessation of suffering, then if we're not willing to see into the possibility of letting go, like you're saying, the allowing it to be, then we won't necessarily see things as they really are. We'll always see things as we think they are. What we think is going on, and get trapped there. So we don't want to get trapped in our own judgments and opinions about what we think is going on. And instead, we want to just let it be. And I think that's why Greg's Schiff's understanding that the end of suffering and suffering itself are the same thing. That if you're willing to be still with suffering, you'll see it as it truly is, and you'll know exactly the appropriate response to make. But it takes some trusting to do that. It's not so easy to do that. I know, because I spent all day fighting against it. Okay, so we probably should leave it there so we could do a couple of announcements.